Tamara Friebel versus Visiting Nurse Association of Mid-Ohio et al. For the appellants, we have first Mr. Hendershot.
Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. On behalf of the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, I'm going to take the first 6 minutes of appellant's time and then yield the balance to Mr. Lewis on behalf of the employer. In those 6 minutes, I want to cover these 3 points. I want to talk about the Bureau's role here. I want to talk about problems with dual intent generally. I want to talk about those problems illustrated in the Fifth District's opinion. The Bureau's role here is a concern with doctrine, not with result. That's why its suggested solution is to vacate the Fifth District's opinion and send this case back to the trial court where either party may prevail. It may be after additional motion practice, additional discovery, and maybe after a full trial, as Ms. Friebel said at page 12 in her brief opposing jurisdiction in this court, that she expects a trial. The Bureau's concern with doctrine is with doctrinal stability in this area, and it has that concern for a couple of reasons. One, as the administrator and litigator of thousands of cases a year, the Bureau is a repeat player and is concerned that because of the high volume of cases here, that the doctrine remains stable. Another reason the Bureau is concerned about doctrinal stability is because of the settled expectations that sit on top of doctrinal stability.
What doctrine are you speaking about? Is this the scope of employment or dual intent?
Well, here we're talking about the doctrine. I would say the easiest shorthand for it, Your Honor, would be to talk about Ruckman versus Cubby Drilling. So that is, in the Bureau's view, lays out the test in this area. It lays out how to first approach the question to—
The test of what?
The test of whether someone is, yes, you're right, ultimately to look to the statutory language, the test of whether an injury to an employee while traveling is in the course of and arising out of the employment.
Had the employee deviated from the scope of employment at the time of the incident?
Your Honor, we think that question shows, that actually illustrates, we think, one of the problems with the Fifth District's approach, and that is whether there was a deviation. To answer that question intelligently, we think you first have to decide whether Ms. Friebel was a commuter or a traveler, or in the words of Ruckman, to decide whether she was a fixed situs employee or not. Once you've answered that question, then it makes sense to decide whether she had deviated.
Does the Bureau have a position as to whether she was or wasn't a fixed situs employee?
Your Honor, we think on the thinness of this record, the right result is to remand to the, after vacating this idea of dual intent, vacating the effective summary judgment in Friebel's favor and sending it back. The Bureau does not take a position on who should ultimately prevail on that question. We think it really should be sent back to the trial court.
So the Bureau's view is that this case got off track on a dual intent theory, and it should be done on traditional doctrinal principles of course and scope of employment and deviation and fixed status employee.
That's absolutely right. We think it may not require a long opinion at all. It may be a couple of paragraphs that reaffirm the primacy of starting where Ruckman says to start. That's a 1998 case, and that's the last time this court had to address the coming and going rule. I think that illustrates the doctrinal stability in this area. That's
let me ask you a question, if I may. I've done a little bit of work in this matter. I had your job. How can you call a traveling nurse a fixed situs employee as the Bureau did? The staff hearing officer, it was my understanding this employee went from sick patient to sick patient all day long at their homes. If that is a fixed situs employee, what's the situs?
Your Honor, I think an easier way to think about that is the difference between commuting and traveling. I think those are a little more descriptive than fixed situs. That is
I'm using the terms that your client used.
Sure,
your client
that's
said fixed situs, and I'm asking you, what's the situs?
Sure, the fixed situs is each patient's home, and the reason I talk about traveling versus commuting is, take a look, for example, at Judge Hoffman's dissent in the Gillum case. It's another Fifth District case that we cite in our briefs. And there, he does draw the distinction between commuting and traveling for this exact occupation, these visiting home health aides.
So you're saying that if I see 8 patients in a day, I have 8 fixed situses per day?
I think really the distinction to draw is between commuting in and then traveling between patients. So the distinction is that the commute, just like if I work at the State Office Tower downtown, so I commute there. If I then walk over to your building to file something, that's traveling for business. So I can do both in the same day. And that's the point of Judge Hoffman's dissent, is that even for occupations like visiting home health aides.
I'm not really concerned with Judge Hoffman. I'm concerned with what you want this court to say today. You'd like us to say a travel nurse has 8 fixed situses a day?
No, we're actually not asking you to make law on that point at all, Your Honor. I think it is an open question on this record. It is possible, as the Fifth District held in Gillum, as the Ninth District held in Mitchell, both cases we've cited in our opening brief, it is possible that a portion of the day for a visiting home health aide is like commuting. Maybe not the portion between patients, but the portion between home and the first patient.
Is she paid by the her agency on the weekends? Wasn't that what was determined when she commuted?
Your Honor, as I read the record, every day of the week, whether it was Monday or Saturday, she was paid both time and mileage between patients. There was a difference on the weekends, this is my reading of the deposition, that her travel between her house, which was a bit away from where most of her patients were, I think 12 miles or 15 miles, and that first patient was only compensated in that same way, mileage and time on the weekends.
She was paid travel time and mileage on the weekends from the time she left her home to go to the first patient's home. Does that complicate or make this a unique situation with regards to the classification of commuter versus traveler? Because I understand what you're saying about a commuter. You leave your home, you go to your place of employment, and then if you're a traveler, you're going from site to site to site during the day, which is all covered if you are in an auto accident while you're going from your first patient to your second, et cetera. But I think what you've got here is a problem, a hybrid situation, where you have the commuting compensated as a traveler.
Your Honor, this court has addressed the question a couple of times. If you look at the Heil versus Industrial Commission decision back in 1931, court said, don't let compensation for travel be the driving factor in determining that statutory question, is the injury arising out of and in the course.
Counsel, that's what I wanted to hear, the arising out of employment, because here we're talking about did the injury occur while the individual was in employment? And you have dual intent, scope of employment, the coming and going rule. We have so many different ways to talk about these issues, and that's why the cases may be a bit confusing, because everybody takes a piece of it and analyzes it in that way. What way should we be analyzing this case? What's the most important point?
Your Honor, I think that's absolutely right. The dual intent adds something that really just adds to a lack of clarity in this area, and we think what this court can do to benefit institutionally, this area is to reaffirm what it said in Ruckman, to start with the question of whether it's commuting or traveling. Once you've made that decision, you can work down the decision tree from that point as to different exceptions to the coming and going rule or different exceptions to
business
travel.
How do you determine a commuter versus a traveler?
Well, probably like this court said in both Fisher and Lohr, that is, unfortunately, workers' compensation cases do have a lot of factors to throw in.
So
I think dual intent.
The course and scope of employment, how does that relate to your classification as a commuter versus a traveler?
Sure. So the statutory starting point is definitely the course of and arising out of. The coming and going rule is something with a pedigree that even predates Ohio statute, goes back to English law. It is a first level judicial gloss on that statutory language. As this court said in Ruckman, we think that's the right place to start.
Counsel, if I understand, because this discussion prompts in my mind another new interesting prong that hasn't been explored, but what you're really saying to us is the facts haven't been developed enough. Some of these legal questions that we're batting back and forth right now could well be answered in this case after it goes back and has a trial.
That's absolutely right.
Is that what you're suggesting? And I think, for example, the one that just occurred to me is the administrative director of our court lives in Lebanon. He drives to Columbus. During that drive, some of us have business to transact with him. No, it's a good time to, so he's working on the phone during the drive, even though it would otherwise clearly be a commute. Is that, again, an example of an issue that just isn't ripe for us to decide in this case at this point in time?
There's certainly endless variation because everyone travels for work, and it's definitely not something I think is ripe in this case. The Bureau's bottom line is we should vacate the decision below because it detracts clarity from this area to reaffirm the primacy of Ruckman as the starting place, and I've seriously invaded Mr. Lewis's time. So with your indulgence, I want to give him a chance to speak with you.
Right. Mr. Lewis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. My name is Michael Lewis. As Mr. Hendershot indicated today, I am sharing time with him. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The matter is before this court today on the Court of Appeals decision to vacate the summary judgment granted in favor of V&A. In doing so, the Court of Appeals asked two questions, and they were the wrong two questions. And in asking those questions, they obtained the wrong answers. The first question was, did the employee have a subjective future intent to enter into their employment and do something beneficial to their employer? In answering that question, the Court of Appeals created the dual intent doctrine. That is a doctrine that does not exist in the state of Ohio.
Counsel, I would suggest it may not exist in this case, and let me tell you why. If a nurse lives in Toledo and has a sick patient in Sandusky, if they are driving from Toledo to Sandusky, they are in the course and scope of their employment, are they not?
Not necessarily, Your Honor.
Why are they going to Sandusky then?
They're going there, that is part of their commute to their fixed situs of employment. It is
but they're not only going to Sandusky for one day.
Yes, but it is the job site at the patient's home where the LPN would provide the health care to the patient, the treatment, assessing the patient.
So if a truck driver picks up a load of steel in Toledo and he must deliver it to Sandusky, is he in the course and scope of his employment on his way to Sandusky?
If a drunk driver does, Your Honor, no.
Truck driver.
I'm sorry, I thought you said a drunk truck driver. It's
That is
a definite no, Your Honor. That's a statutory exception.
Let's not make these facts any more confusing than they already are. Truck driver goes from Toledo to Sandusky hauling a load of steel. Is he in the course and scope of his employment?
Yes.
A nurse goes from Toledo to Sandusky bringing his or her nurse skills to the patient. Are they in the course and scope of their employment?
No. It's Why? The difference between the nurse is on a commute. She has substantial duties to perform at the patient's home. The truck driver is performing those substantial duties during the pendency of the entire commute. He is delivering those items necessary for his job.
What if she therefore has to pick up a patient in Vermilion after Sandusky? Is she a commuter at that time?
She is a commuter until she picks up the patient. And it also depends on if the employer
So in the trip from Sandusky to Vermilion, she's not in the course and scope of her employment?
No, not unless she was put on that special errand by her employer.
But aren't all of these factual questions? And isn't that the whole point of the state's position, is we need to develop the facts in this record more to know, did she have to have specialized equipment in her car? Was that part of her employment? And don't we need to send it back in order to develop those facts in this case?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. The facts in this case are developed.
So you disagree with the state on that point?
Yes, that is the one fact we do disagree with the state on. Here, it is clear and undisputed that at the time of her injury, the claimant left her home with 4 children in her car with the present activity of going to the mall to take those children shopping. After she left the mall, she then intended on going to her fixed situs of employment, which was at the patient's home. She never entered into the course or scope of her employment.
Aren't you taking some liberty with geography there?
No, Your Honor.
Isn't the mall on the way between home and the first patient?
For the purposes of V&A's motion for summary judgment, the facts must assume that she would have taken this route regardless. Although there were 2 alternative routes available to her, which she knew about, she did not take.
So what you're saying is that no matter whether she had stopped at the mall or got into an accident with no intervening mall stop, she was a commuter. And that takes her out of there's nothing that was presented to suggest that commute was in the course and scope of her employment.
Correct.
Okay, you're saying that, but the state is saying we'd like to have some more facts on the table before we can say that conclusively. In with regards to the parameters of her employment, her understanding, her employer's position on her, what her normal course of conduct was, especially what I see muddying the waters here, is the fact she was compensated on the weekends for this, what you're classifying as a commute. So those are all fuzzy areas that may need to be fleshed out and dealt with in the trial format.
Your Honor, the issue of compensation is relevant to the determination of whether the claimant was in the course of the scope of her employment at the time of her injury. You have to look at the present activity being performed at the time of the injury. What was the claimant doing? At that time, the claimant was driving her children to the mall.
What happens if she was on the telephone and she was talking to her employer to get specific directions, for example, to this patient's home? She was commuting, and yet she was communicating with her employer.
Well, of course, that is not the facts of this case. However, I believe she would still be a commuter. She is just communicating for directions on how to get to her fixed site of employment. Just communicating does not necessarily place her within the course or arising out of her employment.
What if the contract, and I don't know that this is the case, but what if the contract includes transportation and says you will be compensated, as the chief says, compensated for driving to your various locations? Just as the truck driver, part of the employment is the transport. That's included in the employment. If the commuting is included within the employment, doesn't that make it within this scope and arising out of, if there's an injury, it arises out of the employment, depending on what the parties bargain for?
No, Your Honor, the compensation here only confuses the issue because the claimant was not paid Monday through Friday to commute to her first patient's home or from her last patient's home. She was compensated as an incentive on the weekends to travel to the first patients and from the last patients.
Well, isn't that a condition of employment? We want you to work on the weekends, so we're going to enhance your compensation directly related to employment, and that serves our benefit as an employer to have a weekend nurse, someone who's willing to take time and work on the weekends. That's servicing the employer.
Yes, but it does not place her in the course of, and it would also bring about an illogical result in this case, because if she's not compensated to travel to the patient's home on the weekdays, but compensated on the weekends, then according to the Court of Appeals decision, this claim is compensable on the weekends, but not on the weekdays.
Well, that's just the fact of life. That's her employment arrangement. But you've used your time, and we thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Mr. Flowers.
Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court. My name is Paul Flowers. I represent the claimant appellee in this case, Tamara Friebel. I think it's important to put the Fifth District decision into proper perspective. It is not as dramatic as is being laid out. All the Fifth District said was that the claimant, Tamara Friebel, had dual intentions at the time of the accident, and that's an undisputed fact. I mean, there is no question that she had two objectives that day, was in the process of fulfilling both of them when her vehicle was struck from behind by another motorist.
Is the Fifth District inviting this court down a brand new path? I've never heard that phrase before. Dual intention, is that a new invention?
No, in fact, the Fifth District never says dual intent doctrine. All they say is she had dual intentions. That does not disqualify her from benefits.
And I'm asking you, is that found anywhere in Ohio law other than this opinion?
No. I don't think so.
So it's a new invention.
Yeah, I mean it's. I do have
I'm
to say.
I'm just trying to ask you. I mean, do you want us to follow that new invention or no?
Oh, absolutely. With all my heart, I want you to follow. but you know, I'd love to be able to say no. You know, there's this case, there's that case. There's lots of cases that have found that. But all the Fifth District said was that look, the statute only requires a causal connection to the employment. If you satisfy the statute, you are entitled to benefits regardless of whether there's another motive there. That's all the Fifth District said. And that's this court in Starkey versus Builders First Source just 3 years ago. The University of Toledo College of Law, one of their most distinguished alumni, Justice Lanzinger, wrote for the court, as long as the injury, As long as the injury has a causal connection, whether direct or aggravated, to the claimant's employment, the claimant is entitled to benefits. And that follows from Kohlmeier versus Keller, 1970, neck fracture case where the employee's at a company picnic. This court said that the employee must be engaged in a purely personal pursuit or errand to deny benefits. And that's really the issue here, and that was the issue below, and that's always been the issue is, can this claimant satisfy the statutory test in the course of, arising out of? If she can satisfy that, it doesn't really matter whether she had another objective she was fulfilling.
The Bureau is arguing to us that we should remand this for some more traditional, I think Mr. Hendershot said, doctrinal explanation. And what is your view about the necessity to clarify, especially in light of your response to Justice O'Neill's question, that this is sort of taking us down a new road here?
I hope I didn't say that we were going down a new road. I mean, it's the right road. It's the first time I've seen it expressed this way, it's such a production has been made out of the fact that she had a second purpose, and really that's that part that happens. You have employees, as the examples were, talking their cell phones to the boss when they're hit. One example I came up with, was the traveling salesman who has to fly to another city where his mother also happens to live. He's going to fly to the city to make a sales call, but before he goes there, he's going to visit his mother. You know, according to them, if the plane crashes on his way on the way there, there's no benefits because he's actually going to see his mother first. And then the only part of the trip that's business related is from his mother's house to the sales call. That's just nonsense. You know, he's going there for the primary objective of making the sales call, which will further the employer's business.
So is that the analysis, primary versus secondary?
That I haven't heard that, but it makes sense.
But we have the traditional coming and going rule and the commuters, and I think, if I understand Mr. Hendershot, that's what he wants us to do. He wants this case to get more in the traditional analysis mode because of the confusion that may come from what the Fifth District has done.
Well, I'm all for that, what he says. And for the life of me, I can't understand why the Attorney General's office switched sides in this case. I mean, it just makes no sense to me because the Fifth District did follow the traditional approach. They said, we're going to follow the traditional approach even if she might have had another purpose. You know, and the General Assembly has never adopted a statute that says the employee must have one sole specific work-related purpose at the time of the injury in order for there to be benefits.
But Mr. Flowers, the problem is when we're talking about direct connection to employment, here the Fifth District seems to suggest there's a subjective intent. And that's the troubling thing. I mean, we're going beyond what's objectively related to employment and what the employee may, after the fact, say, oh, this was my intent. It was my intent to go to work, and so therefore I'm covered by the workers' comp instead of just looking to normal insurance or the tortfeasor that hits me from behind. And isn't that the problem here, that we would be opening up into a totally new area that is really governed by what is said later by the employee about what my intent was?
Yeah, that's always been a problem. You know, not just dual intent cases, but all the cases where the employee says, I was thinking about my job,
right.
You know, and that's when the accident happened, so it's work-related. You know, that's always been a problem. Here we have the surrounding circumstances that confirms beyond all dispute what she was intending to do. I mean, first, the accident report shows she had the kids in the back of the car, so we know she's going to stop at the mall. That's undisputed. Second of all, we know that the employer had scheduled her to be at that patient's home that day. She's wearing her uniform. She's got her badge on. She's got her equipment with her. She's bringing her nursing training with her. All that we know, she is going to that patient's home.
But wait a minute. Didn't you oppose summary judgment in the trial court? So you said there were factual questions that needed to be decided?
At the trial court... You're testing me now. I know at the Court of Appeals we agreed that the facts were not in dispute.
Right. But we at said the trial that, court, you opposed summary judgment and didn't move for summary judgment on your own.
We did not move for summary judgment on our own. True. I can't remember whether we said the facts were in dispute. I don't think we would because the only evidence was the plaintiff's deposition. Now, that was the only evidence ever introduced. I don't think I'd argue my client's testimony creates a disputed issue of fact. I mean, that was the only testimony.
But you didn't move for summary judgment.
Correct.
And you opposed summary judgment on behalf of the employer.
Yeah, we didn't want them to get summary judgment, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But, okay. Yeah, that just gets into the second proposition of law And maybe I'll just go there briefly. I mean, you know, the case they're citing, give me just a second. Marshall versus Aaron. I mean, that dealt with a situation where you have a non-moving defendant and a non-moving plaintiff, and the court grants summary judgment for the non-moving defendant. I mean, that you can't do. But here we had a situation where they come out of the gate saying the facts are not in dispute. Here's her deposition. The facts are not in dispute. We want you to rule and determine judgment as a matter of law. You know, they say that over and over in their motion, in their appeal brief. They say the facts are undisputed. It's not until they get the ruling that's adverse to them that all of a sudden they say, hey, we should have had an opportunity to dispute these undisputed facts. You know, and this court rejected that in State X Rel Cuyahoga County versus BWC. I mean, it's a mandamus case, but the same civil rules apply in mandamus cases. An entry of summary judgment against the moving party does not prejudice his due process rights where all relevant evidence is before the court, no genuine issues of any material fact exist, and the non-moving party is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. So yes, it's true we were a non-moving party, but you know, everybody had an opportunity to present evidence. All that was there was the plaintiff's deposition, which is uncontradicted. So sure, I mean, the most expedient approach, particularly in a workers' compensation appeal that involves a neck sprain, is to resolve it as a matter of law and summary judgment and move on to the next case.
So if there's no disagreement as to what the facts are here, what is the benefit of sending it back for some doctrinal stability? I'm not sure that I understand why that would be of benefit, because as every case is fact-specific, and we know what the facts are here, and the question, was it not developed through her deposition? What benefit she was providing her employer, was that nebulous, left unanswered in her deposition?
Well, yeah, just start off with the first part of your question, Chief Justice. I don't see any reason to go back for doctrinal stability. I mean, we're admitting that you have to satisfy the in the course of it arising out of test, and maybe the court should just uphold that. That's what the Fifth District held. I don't know what you would go, I mean.
Well, the confusion here is this term, dual intent or dual purpose, and to interject something like that, you know for sure you could take that, you got an inch and you're taking a mile there, you know.
As is my way.
Yeah, exactly. So the specificity to address that, you know, I think that's what the problem is with the Attorney General here.
Yeah, and again, I don't understand their concern, because we're flat out saying we agree with them that, you know, it doesn't matter what the case is about and what the circumstances are. You have to satisfy that two-part statutory test to be entitled to benefits. And all the Fifth District said is we're going to follow that approach regardless of whether there's a second intention here, a personal intent.
So we don't even have, I mean, if we issue an opinion here affirming and say, you know, we affirm, but in essence almost on different rationale or different basis here, that we don't need to even look at what the intent was. In other words, stop leaving from point A, going to stop at point B, and then on to point C. We just apply the old-fashioned standards, the tried and true benefits of the employer, course and scope of employment, and defer to the court on that.
Correct. And it's, you know, here, I mean, we don't have disputed facts, so I don't see that there's any reason to go beyond that. I mean, there's no reason to go back down and have a trial on these issues that have already been resolved, these particular issues. So you're correct. I mean, I think all that needs to be said here is that, you know, regardless of the circumstances, regardless of the case, you have to pass the statutory test, the causal connection test, and the fact that there's a second purpose here will not disqualify you from benefits.
And you're essentially arguing we can and should win, and you can write the opinion in a fashion that covers Mr. Hendershot's concern that a new test was injected by just ignoring that or saying we don't need that to
right.
decide the matter in your favor.
Right, you've got me on film saying we don't need a new test. You know, the old law is fine.
Mr.
As much as you like it.
Yeah, exactly. It's a tough test as it is. We don't need to make it worse.
Mr. Flowers, as a matter of curiosity, was the tortfeasor sued in this case?
You know, I don't know. If the tortfeasor was, there'd be subrogation rights, and the Bureau would be getting their money back that way. Oh, there has to be, because it's a rear-end auto accident. So I'm sure there was, but subrogation prevents any double recovery, if that's your concern.
So in your view, the commuting part of this, is it, how do we determine if a situation that occurs during commuting should be considered arising out of the scope of employment?
Well, typically, if they're commuting, they're not in the course and scope of employment. That's the coming and going rule.
You're saying she was not commuting here.
Correct. We're saying she is non-fixed sitist. Right? The idea that she's got 8 different job sites, or actually be more than that because she's seeing 60 patients a week, that she has 60 different job sites over the course of the week, that's just absurd. Because nobody is ever going to satisfy that test.
But was that an issue that was agreed upon, the fixed situs?
No, the employer's fighting everything. You know.
So I'm saying here, you're saying here that the facts are not all agreed upon.
The facts are agreed upon. The conclusions are not, all right? And the facts are that this woman drove an awful lot through a rural part of Ohio, put a lot of miles on her car for which she was reimbursed. And Chief Justice O'Connor,
Mr. Plowers, also there is a fact that's in dispute, because the employer is suggesting that the nurse would have been starting for work after she dropped her children off at the mall.
But that's an assertion by a lawyer.
I understand that.
You know, that's not evidence, because they didn't submit an affidavit.
Well, the
from
fact
the
is, at the time of the accident, she was on her way to drop her children off at a shopping mall.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Now, I've said that. She had dual purposes, whatever you want to call it, but that doesn't disqualify her necessarily from benefits.
Was there a contract here, a written contract that was entered into evidence?
No. You know, if she said anything in her deposition that was untruthful, the employer could have submitted an affidavit. So that's not true, but there's no question she was working portal to portal that Saturday. She's paid the entire time, you know, that she was out there. And Chief Justice O'Connor, just to go back to the original question you asked about whether that complicates things for the employer, it certainly does, because the fact she's getting paid to travel shows that travel is an integral part of her job duties. And in the Ruckman case...
Well, don't you have to take it farther than that? Why is she being paid to travel on a weekday as opposed to a weekend as opposed to the weekday? Mm-hmm. You could interpret that to be that it might be difficult to get nurses to work on the weekend, to visit these homes on the weekend, so it's to the employer's benefit to have an employee working on the weekends, because people are sick 7 days a week, not just 5 days a week. And
right.
For those services to be rendered, you know, it here's what we're going to do that's in our interest as the employer to entice someone to work on the weekends.
Right, yeah, we're going to make it worthwhile for you. And every employer I know, I mean, none of them pay employees for personal time. They're paying them because what the employee is doing is giving them a benefit. You know, and that's the case here. They were paying her, travel's an integral part of her job, and that's all that Ruckman requires, is that if travel's an integral part of the job, the employee's non-fixed situs and the coming and going rule doesn't apply. We'd ask you
to
affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you very much, Chief Justice. Quickly, affirming the Court of Appeals' decision would effectively grant summary judgment in favor of the claimant. The Court of Appeals' decision focuses on the subjective future intent and not the activity being performed at the time of the injury. Again, we have to look at what was this claimant doing at the time of her accident that benefited the employer. Driving her 4 children to the mall was not a benefit to VNA. It was a benefit to herself.
But it was en route to her employment.
The fact that it may have been en route does not matter. One, she had never entered the course of her employment because her employment was at the patient's house. Two, in Crockett versus HCR Manor Care, a home health aide had to travel between 2 patients' home, taking an infant goddaughter from one patient's home towards the next patient's home, but she had to stop at a service station to drop off her goddaughter. The Court of Appeals in that case stated that although it may have furthered her employment by traveling towards the next patient, at the time of the accident, she was taking a personal benefit in delivering that child.
So why don't we reverse and remand for trial in this case?
Because there are no questions of material fact to be decided.
You're agreeing with Mr. Flowers that there are no questions of fact here. It's either you or he that gets the decision.
No, Your Honor. There is no question of fact as to the issue that was before the Court of Appeals, and that was V&A's motion for summary judgment. For the summary judgment that the claimant did not file, there is a question of fact regarding the two alternate routes that the claimant looked at on her way to work that day, but did not take. Those
so
were quicker routes.
Are you taking issue with Civil Rule 56 because there was no motion for summary judgment filed? The Court of Appeal cannot grant that motion? Is that your argument?
For the second proposition of law, yes, Your Honor. Rule 56 states that a motion for summary judgment may only be granted against a party adverse to that motion, which means the motion may only be granted against the non-moving party. So it was improper for the Court of Appeals to ignore this court's civil rule of procedure and grant summary judgment in favor of a non-moving party.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll take the matter under advisement, gentlemen, and you will be notified of our decision.